to a very critical stage. And we want to get the whole Russia-Ukraine thing done.
President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin had a highly anticipated phone call today. How are their talks affecting the war in Ukraine?
For Tuesday, March 18th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration is gutting the agency that funds longtime broadcaster Voice of America.
It was source of truth when things are changing rapidly.
Also, actor Natasha Rothwell from The White Lotus reflects on her parents' influence.
My dad is losing his eyesight in one of his eyes, and my mom just got her knee replaced. And I'm always joking. I'm like, you guys don't make a whole person unless you're together.
And the journey home for two astronauts after their one-week trip to space turned into 9 months.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Israeli military says the ceasefire has officially ended in Gaza with a new Israeli offensive. Gaza health officials say has killed hundreds. A senior Hamas official says international mediators have not presented it with a new ceasefire proposal since Israel's newest offensive began. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Israel's offensive is dubbed Operation Strength and Sword. An internal Israeli government memo obtained by NPR says, quote, Israel is returning to intensified fighting in Gaza. Israel says its offensive is to press Hamas to accept a proposal by President Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff for the release of more Israeli hostages. Hamas offered a counterproposal last week, which the U.S. and Israel rejected. Senior Hamas official Bassem Naim, based in Qatar, told NPR that mediators have not presented Hamas with a new framework for a ceasefire. Naim says the U.S. must, quote, intervene immediately to stop this aggression, and for Israel to adhere to a January agreement to enter talks for a permanent end of the war. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Federal judges ruled the Trump administration likely violated the Constitution when it effectively shuttered the U.S. Agency for International Development. U.S. District Court Judge Theodore Chuang also blocking Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency from further cuts to the agency. Judge ordered the Trump administration to restore email and computer access to all employees, including those placed on administrative leave. The plaintiffs are more than two dozen unnamed current or recently fired employees and contractors of the agency. Department of Government Efficiency placed USAID workers on administrative leave last month, firing many. President Trump is encountering a rare public rebuke from the Chief Justice of the U.S., John Roberts. Trump had called for the impeachment of a judge who ordered a temporary halt to migrant deportation flights. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports Trump's statement on social media spurred a pointed response today from the head of the federal judiciary.
Chief Justice Roberts issued a statement emphasizing that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreements with judicial decisions. Carl Tobias is a law professor at the University of Richmond.
No judge has ever been impeached, much less convicted by the Senate, for making decisions with which presidents and members of the Senate and House disagree.
Tobias says in nearly 250 years, a total of 15 judges have been the subject of impeachment in the House, and only eight of them have been convicted in the Senate. All were matters of high crimes and misdemeanors. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks took another swing to the downside today amid continued uncertainty about Trump administration tariffs and worries about a possibility of a U.S. recession. The Dow fell 260 points. The Nasdaq fell more than 300 points. This is NPR. A pair of NASA astronauts who spent far longer aboard the International Space Station than they expected because of Boeing's problem-plagued Starliner capsule are coming home. Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams returning aboard a SpaceX capsule that is scheduled to splash down this evening off the coast of Florida, weather permitting. The two were only scheduled to be in space for about 8 days, but wound up spending 9 months aboard the International Space Station. The longtime leaders of both Serbia and Hungary have been shaken by growing protest movements. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports analysts say they've never been so vulnerable.
Taxi drivers and farmers join students to protest what they call years of cronyism and corruption under Serbian leader Aleksandar Vučić.
Serbia absolutely lacks the proper rule of law. There is very little respect for the constitution.
That's analyst Ivana Stradner with the D.C.-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. She describes her home country as a hybrid regime with a weak democracy, but says young people are fed up with the cult of personality and want a better future. Similar protests shook neighboring Hungary, where opposition to Viktor Orban's 15-year hold on power is growing. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News.
Labs and Golden Retrievers are still up there in terms of popular U.S. dog breeds, number 2 and 3, respectively, according to the American Kennel Club. But for the fourth year running, the French Bulldog is holding down the number 1 spot. Breeders say it can be a mixed blessing. Meanwhile, keep an eye on a breed you may not have heard of, the Cane Corso. The powerful and protective Italian Mastiff has gone from 47th to number 14 in terms of ranking in just a decade. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
It is 4:06. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Slight chance of snow this evening, lows in the 20s, and tomorrow partly sunny with highs in the mid-30s. Breezy north winds gusting up to 30 miles per hour. More news is next.
On a Tuesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump spoke at length this morning with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. The highly anticipated phone call comes as the U.S. president tries to broker a ceasefire to end Russia's war in Ukraine. NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid joins us now for more. Hi, Asma.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us more about what Trump and Putin talked about today.
Well, Trump has been trying to reach a truce to end the 3-year war in Ukraine, and he got a first step today. The Kremlin said that it'll stop strikes on energy infrastructure for the next 30 days. Now, this discussion did not result in a concrete peace agreement, but the White House issued a statement saying that the U.S. and Russia agreed to start talks toward a ceasefire, and those negotiations will begin immediately out in the Middle East. They referenced not just energy infrastructure, but also negotiations toward implementing a maritime ceasefire in the Black Sea.
And we should note that Ukraine was not part of this call, right? Like, any word on what Ukraine is thinking about all of this dialogue?
Well, we're waiting to hear. We know that last week, Ukraine had agreed to a broad month-long ceasefire. And today's phone call was now an effort to convince Russia to agree to that same pause as well. Trump didn't really get there, but the White House is continuing the talks because Trump really wants to end this war. You know, he campaigned on that commitment. He has expressed sympathy about all the bloodshed lost, but he's also complained about the billions and billions of dollars that he said his predecessor, Joe Biden, has sent to assist Ukraine in this war.
So, Asma, what is the sticking point to a broader deal here?
Well, the Kremlin said in a statement today that Moscow wants a long-term settlement, but Putin is also insisting on an end to foreign intelligence sharing and military aid to Ukraine. One big additional question that our colleague Charles Maines, who's based in Russia, points out is that Putin has raised the issue of who will monitor this ceasefire. He does not want any NATO countries to be the monitor here, and Putin also believes that any long-term agreement has to deal with what he believes is the root of this conflict, and that is NATO's expansion at Russia's borders. He absolutely does not want Ukraine to be a part of NATO ever, and to that point, I mean, Trump has also said that he doesn't think Ukraine's membership into NATO is realistic.
Well, what about from Ukraine's side here? Like, what are they holding out for?
Well, one major point is that they have wanted security guarantees from the United States and Europe because they don't trust that Putin will stick to his end of the deal. You probably recall that this was a major point for Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky when he met with President Trump last month here at the White House. I mean, I'm sure that you remember that contentious meeting in the Oval Office.
Oh, yeah.
U.S.-Ukraine talks fell apart then, and the Ukraine delegation was told to leave. But last week, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Trump's National Security Advisor Michael Walls went to to Saudi Arabia for new fresh talks with Ukrainians. And they got Ukraine to agree to a 30-day ceasefire, which was a big development. That's what they're trying to get Russia to sign on to.
Okay, so what do all of these developments mean ultimately for President Trump, you think?
You know, Elsa, I would say that, as I mentioned, he is eager to end this war. He has been optimistic even about the idea of dividing up assets. Ever since he returned to the White House broadly, he has changed the conventional wisdom around American foreign policy, and he's been willing to engage directly with Putin, which, you know, frankly, we never saw Biden do during the war. He's also, though, aligned himself much more with Russia philosophically, adopting its viewpoint and blaming Ukraine for starting the war, even though, to be clear, it was Russia who invaded Ukraine.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Thank you, Asma.
Good to speak with you.
Democrats have grown increasingly frustrated with their party's leadership, which is struggling to oppose President Trump's agenda. Now, this all spilled out into the open during last week's spending fight in Congress. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer refused to block a GOP spending plan that left Democrats out of the negotiation process. That whole episode surfaced concerns about Democratic strategy, or lack thereof. For more on that, we have NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi there.
Hey, great to be with you.
To cut to the chase, where do Democrats go from here?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, it's not totally unusual for the out party to not have a specific leader or to struggle in figuring out, you know, what the best strategy is while being in the minority and trying to find their way back to the majority and out in the political wilderness. You know, who knows what'll happen 4 years from now? I mean, nobody really thought that when Obama got into office, the next Republican president would be Donald Trump, but here we are. But before we even get to 2028, you know, more pressingly for Democrats politically, it's important for them to try and be united to try and take back at least the House in next year's midterm elections, which are lower turnout affairs than presidential elections. And you need that activism. You know, the Senate is more out of reach given the seats that are up for grabs there.
You mentioned lower turnout affairs. Stay there for a second. And this idea of needing to turn out the base. Do you have a sense of how people are viewing the response Democrats have had to Trump at this point?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a host of polls out in recent days showing Democrats with historically low favorability ratings, and they were all taken before that shutdown back and forth that happened. You know, these polls really reflect the frustrations of rank-and-file Democrats. For example, in the latest CNN poll, which had Democrats at just 29% favorability, independents were at 19% approval of the Democratic Party. That's pretty bad. Yeah. But when it came to Republicans, it was about the same, 20% among independents. So basically the same thing. The issue has been Democratic respondents in these surveys. 63% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents had a favorable opinion of their party. That's pretty low compared to what it generally is across other polling that we've seen. A slim majority of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents think leadership is taking the party in the wrong direction. And what direction is it that they want? Well, they don't want Democrats in Congress to work with Republicans. Almost 6 in 10 said that, a huge switch from when Trump was first in office. So lots of frustration from Democratic voters who want to see their party show more fight.
Well, and I'm still mulling, Domenico, something you said there, that these polls, these really bad polls for Democrats, those were from before the funding bill dust up. So those numbers, they could get even worse.
Certainly could. I mean, at least temporarily. And again, though, the party is going to need to figure out how to get on the same page to be able to make inroads in next year's elections. And we saw some of that attempted over the weekend with, you know, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Senate leader, and House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries meeting up. Jeffries sort of trying to take the temperature down after saying that they disagreed on the approach to shutdown, but that they agree on the issues going forward. And Schumer is certainly facing a lot of backlash from rank-and-file Democrats, even canceling a scheduled book tour for, quote, security reasons.
Hey, what about outside of Congress, away from Capitol Hill? Who else might emerge as the heir apparent, a party leader?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say now, but there are a ton of potential names and people who are trying to emerge as the one to lead the party. People like Alyssa Slotkin, the senator from Michigan, who gave that response to Trump's joint address to Congress. Gavin Newsom, the California governor, who, you know, has started a new podcast controversially with the base, spoken to right-wing people with ties to Trump, like Steve Bannon and Charlie Kirk. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the New York congresswoman, and Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, are on a town hall tour together. And even people like former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is weighing a 2028 presidential run. And I bet you there's going to be a whole lot more people who get into the mix. And look, you know, so much of what we hear about is this fissure within the Democratic Party about progressives versus moderates. But what's overlooked sometimes is who can best make the argument for Democratic big D values. And that's going to be the real challenge.
And PR's Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, Domenico.
You're so welcome.
In Germany, lawmakers have approved changes to the constitution to allow for unprecedented spending on defense. As Esme Nicholson reports, the historic vote brings an end to decades of austerity, and it is meant as a message for Washington and Moscow to take Berlin seriously.
After 5 hours of tense debate in the Bundestag, Chancellor-in-waiting Friedrich Merz got the supermajority needed to change the constitution to lift strict limits on deficit spending. Merz, whose conservative party has always been a staunch advocate of fiscal prudence, argued that extraordinary times called for unlimited defense spending and a whopping $540 billion infrastructure investment package.
Such debt can only be justified in very specific circumstances. These circumstances are Putin's war against Europe. We will defend ourselves with everything we have at our disposal in the coming years and decades, ladies and gentlemen.
Merz's plans mark a major mindset shift for a country historically dedicated to balancing the books. Christian Dürr from the neoliberal Free Democrats stressed that Germany's fiscal conservatism is rooted in the desire to protect future generations and accused Merz of making a historical mistake.
Mr. Merz, you argue that this change to our constitution is a necessary response to challenging times. But what you're really doing is pulling the trigger on unbridled debt.
Alexander Gauland from the far-right Alternative for Germany party, which came second in the recent election, accused the future chancellor of a political bait and switch.
Mr. Merz, to get the top job, you deceived your voters by promising to respect our strict rules on borrowing, only to propose racking up billions in debt straight after the election.
But as Merz's victory today shows, he is by no means alone in doubting the strength of the transatlantic alliance.
Without the Americans and NATO, we are not in a position to defend ourselves. But we are changing that, step by step, by building up European defense capabilities.
Merz may have passed his first leadership test. Now he must form a government in order to spend the funds he has secured. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. It is 4:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. We've received support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
On today's date, March 18th, 1983, Larry Olson, an accomplished phenologist from Cass County, noted the return of the eastern meadowlark, known scientifically as Sternella magna, which means, oddly enough, large little starling. And the behavior of the meadowlark and the starling is somewhat similar, especially in winter when they congregate into flocks and fly pretty well together. Meadowlark is a ground-nesting bird, lives in hayfields and open field areas. It weaves a little grass roof for its nest, The numbers increased after the movement of settlers into previously wooded areas that they cleared and created fields and farming. Those numbers decreased when a lot of farms were allowed to return to their more natural state of forests. And so the eastern meadowlark is a bit rare these days. The presence of farming, the haying of hayfields at just exactly the wrong time of the year, has continued to cause the meadowlark some problems. So keep your eyes out. Perhaps this will be the year that you will get to see an eastern meadowlark, especially if you live in areas where farming is prevalent.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. To date, 127 legal cases have been filed against the Trump administration's actions since President Trump took office. That's according to a database maintained at New York University. The cases challenge an enormous range of subjects, from the president's national security powers to the firing of tens of thousands of federal employees at the Pentagon, to the Justice Department, and to agencies created by Congress that are supposed to be independent. Joining us now to talk about all of these lawsuits is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, let's take the first area of these cases. This is where the president traditionally has the most power, national security. What's going on there?
Most prominently, that's the one in which Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to deport several hundred alleged Venezuelan gang members by claiming they were part of an illegal invasion. The law, however, has only been invoked three times in American history, and then only in a declared war. This is the case where the administration is in something of a standoff with the chief judge of the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. here, James Boasberg, because Boasberg ordered the administration not to do what it did while the case was underway, and the administration did it anyway, prompting Boasberg to order the planes that were in the air to turn back, which the administration did not do.
Why might the president not have the power to do what he did here?
Because the Alien Enemies Act, according to most scholars, was meant to and is written to deal with wartime emergencies only. In addition, even people who should be deported are guaranteed due process under the Constitution, and it's not clear that all of the people being deported have had a final hearing. The president has likely picked this battle because, after all, it's what he ran and won on. In addition, in this category, I would put the administration's effort, so far unsuccessful, to ban automatic citizenship for some people born in the United States, a right pretty explicitly guaranteed by the Constitution.
That's right. Okay, what other areas of executive power are you seeing litigated right now? What's standing out?
Well, there are what former Ambassador Norman Eisen, who's shepherding a lot of these lawsuits, calls core rule of law cases. Those are the cases seeking to prevent the administration from gutting agencies and cabinet departments by summarily firing tens of thousands of federal employees. For shorthand, let's call these the Elon Musk cases, involving what power a private individual has to gain access to government databases that are supposed to be private. An individual who's not been confirmed by Congress to do things that Congress has not authorized. Mm-hmm. And under this umbrella, I would put the administration's efforts to make life much more difficult for lawyers who bring cases against the administration and news organizations who cover them. For example, some 20 major law firms have been targeted for alleged DEI violations, and the administration revoked the security clearance for a major law firm, which could put it out of business.
What about what Trump and his allies are calling attacks on the deep state? Like, where would that fit into all of this?
Well, I think they're somewhat different because they're attacks on the control of the agency. So, for example, the president is trying to fire a member of the National Labor Relations Board who has 3 years left on her 5-year term. Now, the Supreme Court back in the 1930s said the president could only fire agency commissioners for cause, meaning misconduct of some kind. The current Supreme Court conservative supermajority, however, has been eating away at the outer edges of that precedent. So the Trump administration has, I think, a pretty decent chance of prevailing when and if these cases get to the Supreme Court.
Okay, well, we've heard that President Trump has called for the impeachment of the judge in the deportations case. Has the Supreme Court weighed in on that yet?
Well, today, the usually reserved Chief Justice John Roberts issued this statement. For more than 2 centuries, it's been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose.
That is NPR's Nina Totenberg. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Elsa.
Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Natasha Rothwell plays Belinda on HBO's The White Lotus. Her character works at a resort on the show, a woman of color surrounded by rich white guests. She says the character is informed by her own experience as a young person thinking about how race and luxury intersect.
I remember traveling when I was real broke and seeing a black person sitting in first class when I was on my way to coach. And it subconsciously let me know that I should be able to do that, that I could do that, that I belonged in that space.
Rothwell helped write a version of that experience into the new season of White Lotus, out now. She reflected on other experiences that have shaped her life with Wildcard host Rachel Martin, including the influence her parents had on her.
What does age teach you about love?
My parents celebrated 47 years being married on the 23rd of February. And I have had a front seat to their love for 44 years. And seeing my parents' love at this age, it's beautiful, you know? They go to each other's appointments and they know each other's meds. It's the cutest thing. And my mom forgets. It's just... Bay and Day are their nicknames for each other. My dad's David, and my mom's Sharon, but baby, so Bay and Day. And she'll be like, no, Day, you can't have that. You know, like, you put that down. You're allergic. And it's a beautiful thing to see that expression of love over time.
And what do you take from what they're teaching you by example? Like, are there things they demonstrated for you that you find that you apply in your own life, in your own relationships?
Yeah, there's just quitting is not on the table. You know, there's the stick-to-itiveness and, you know, they have grown together and have accepted all of those versions of each other. And my dad had a very demanding job in the Air Force, and my mom was raising 4 children, and, you know, there was mutual respect and understanding and levity. Like, they played all the time. And I think, too, like, my dad is, you know, losing his eyesight in one of his eyes, and my mom just got her knee replaced. And I'm always joking. I'm like, you guys don't make a whole person unless you're together. Like, he's got one eye, you got one knee. And I'm just like, what is going on? So there's, like, you know, I see just how ordinary and extraordinary their love is.
You can see Natasha Rothwell in the new season of White Lotus, out now on HBO. And you can hear more of that conversation with Rachel on the Wildcard podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
This is NPR News.
Telemedicine has played a critical role in keeping abortion accessible, but doctors who prescribe pills across state lines are facing a new reality where the criminal risk is no longer hypothetical.
It just hit home that this is real. Like, this could happen to anybody at any time now, which is scary.
That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition begins at 5 a.m. tomorrow on KAXE. Tune in for the Wednesday morning show with Andrew DeZingle and Jen Callen. In the 8 o'clock hour, the Beltrami County Master Gardeners return for Twist and Sprout. This month's topic is houseplants. If you have any questions for them, you can text us 218-326-1234. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, National Native News. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic Gigazone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Slight chance for snow flurries this evening with lows overnight in the 20s, and for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the mid-30s with breezy north winds up to 30 miles per hour.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A project bringing solar energy to the Wind River Reservation has hit some road bumps due to pauses in federal funding. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Hanna Haberman reports, the team's searching for other ways to move forward.
Energize Wind River is poised to set up standalone solar systems and bring electricity to roughly 40 Eastern Shoshone homes. But
the but would be that our construction funding is currently on hold pending review.
That's project director Levi Purdom. He says about $2 million of funding is paused. Even though the project has funding for training, employees, and outreach, it's unable to buy or install the solar equipment. Purdom is optimistic that the funding will eventually come through. But for now, the group secured a $20,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy.
They wanted to support our non-governmental fundraising efforts. So the intent is to hire and fund a fundraising specialist.
Energize Wind River still plans to start construction this spring if they're able to raise enough money. Other tribal nations across the Mountain West are facing similar issues amid budget cuts by the Trump administration. I'm Hanna Haberman.
Marine species like salmon and humpback whales might be becoming more frequent fixtures in the Arctic, especially as sea ice becomes less reliable from climate change. For residents in Alaska's most northern communities, it can mean changes to subsistence. The shifts in migration are also fascinating scientists. KNBA's Alaska Desk reporter Alona Nyden has more.
Catching salmon in the North Slope village of Kaktovik was unheard of not too long ago. But as resident Robert Thompson says, some fishermen now see salmon more regularly. About 5 years ago, Thompson caught a dozen salmon, a small but noticeable number, he says.
Before it was unusual and people would talk about it, but somebody got a salmon, but now it's fairly common.
Fishermen, hunters, and researchers gathered at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage back in January to discuss changing migration patterns of several fish species and marine animals. One of the conference presenters was Elizabeth Mika-Clindley, a graduate student from Bethel who grew up fishing for salmon. For a year, Lindley and other researchers tracked temperatures in the Anaktuvik River, which runs through gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve.
The temperature conditions, it seems like they are survivable.
Less ice might also mean new territory for humpback whales. Oceanographer Kate Stafford says data from local whalers and aerial surveys points to more humpbacks visiting the Chukchi Sea in recent years. In Utqiagvik, humpbacks were sighted only twice before 2021 and 2 to 3 times in years after that. Then, last fall, researchers saw more than 25 whales feeding close together for 2 days in a row.
We came across what I would call humpback palooza.
Utqiagvik whaler Michael Donovan says he did not witness the humpback palooza, but he has seen a few humpbacks during his fall hunts. He says that he and other whalers are worried that humpbacks might be competing for krill and copepods with bowheads, the staple subsistence resource in his community.
Well, definitely they're an invasive species. You know, they come in and eat the same food that our bowheads eat.
Donovan and other hunters say they're supportive of scientists collecting data on whales other than bowheads, which are growing their presence in warming waters in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Okay, so imagine this, everybody. You go on a work trip that's supposed to last a week, and you end up being there for 9 months. Also, that work trip, it's in outer space. I know. All of this sounds nuts, but it is exactly what happened to two American astronauts. Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore will be returning home tonight after being on the International Space Station since last summer. Their visit and return have become political in the past few months, with President Trump and Elon Musk claiming that they were deliberately stranded by the Biden administration. NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfiel has been tracking the space opera and joins us now. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, what a saga. Just tell us more about these two astronauts. Like, where are they right now? Do you know?
Well, yeah, I do. They're on their way down. Williams and Wilmore are seated on board a capsule built by Elon Musk's company, SpaceX. They've just fired their thrusters to come out of orbit, and soon they're going to splash down in the Gulf off the coast of Florida. They're joined by two other astronauts, one astronaut and a Russian cosmonaut who will be returning, although they were not in space quite as long.
Okay, well, it's lovely that they are all returning home safely, but can you just explain why were these two astronauts in space for so long?
Well, it all started in June of last year with their launch aboard an experimental spacecraft built by the company Boeing. That capsule had problems with its thrusters. So after they got everyone safely aboard, NASA decided they were going to send it home without Williams and Wilmore. And in the end, they made them part of the regular space station crew. So they had to stick around, which it turns out was an additional 285 days on the station.
Oh, my God. Okay, and just how unusual is it, Jeff, for astronauts to be in space for that long?
You know, I recently spoke to Scott Kelly. He's a retired astronaut who spent nearly a year aboard the station. He thought this was really a reasonable call.
What made the most sense was to just leave Butch and Sonny up there. I mean, they're professionals.
In fact, Sonny Williams was named commander of the space station for most of her time up there. But, you know, they were originally only supposed to be up there for about a week. So this inevitably started a narrative that they were stuck in space. And it kind of depends what you mean by stuck. They've always had a way to get home.
They had a SpaceX Dragon there as an emergency lifeboat to bring them back at any time they needed to.
I want a Dragon. Okay, so these astronauts, they get reassigned to the space station. That's how this whole saga started. But then how did Trump and Musk amplify the story into they got stuck there on purpose?
Yeah, well, earlier this year, Trump and Musk started claiming that the astronauts were deliberately stranded by the Biden administration. They repeated that again and again. Here's Musk speaking on an interview with Senator Ted Cruz released yesterday.
It wasn't really even a NASA decision. Yeah. It was just that the Biden White House did not want to have someone who was pro-Trump rescuing astronauts right before the election.
Now, numerous NASA officials said that claim simply isn't true. They said there were technical and budgetary reasons to leave Williams and Wilmore up there, and politics had nothing to do with it. I should add that former NASA administrator Bill Nelson also says he never heard from Musk about a rescue plan.
Hmm. And what about the astronauts themselves? How are they holding up?
You know, they're doing fine. Butch Wilmore said he didn't really know about Musk's offer directly to bring him back early.
We are just feel fortunate and thankful, though, that we have seats, and we'll be coming home, riding the plasma, splashing down in the ocean. So that's what we're looking forward to.
And it really won't be long now. As I said, they've started their descent, so they should be down within the hour.
And that is NPR's Jeff Brumfield. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is gutting a federal agency that funds Voice of America and other government broadcasters, this in the name of cost cutting. For decades, these broadcasters reached audiences the U.S. government deemed autocratic, without free media. That includes China. NPR's Emily Fang has this story about Voice of America's legacy there.
Growing up in China in the 1970s, listener Anna Wong remembers how fellow students would secretly tune into Voice of America's shortwave broadcasts. She says listening to VOA was illegal, punishable in some cases by the death penalty. So Wong says later on, even as China relaxed politically, fellow university students surreptitiously listened to VOA under thick blankets in their dorms at midnight.
The news may be good or bad. We shall tell you the truth.
VOA was seen as so subversive, it was nicknamed the Ditai, or enemy channel, in China. It served as a kind of underground transmission for both news and for sharing sounds of resistance, including this song. A song about homesickness and hometowns, beloved by students who were forcibly exiled to the Chinese countryside starting in the 1950s. VOA broadcast the song, boosting its popularity even when the song was officially banned. And as China entered the political foment of the 1980s, VOA's unvarnished reports in English and Mandarin became even more influential.
It was source of truth when things are changing rapidly.
This is Zhou Fengsuo, who became a student leader in mass democracy protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square in 1989. His student union at Beijing's Tsinghua University started broadcasting VOA from its speakers.
That's the way the news of the protests were shared.
Because state media refused to cover the protests. When Beijing sent in tanks to quell the student demonstrators, these VOA reports on the fatal crackdown in Tiananmen Square were broadcast globally. VOA's focus on highlighting dissent meant it was popular among Republican politicians in the U.S., but invariably despised by authoritarian governments abroad. And with its potential closure after Trump ordered the agency that funds it to be dismantled, China's ruling Communist Party must be the happiest people in the world right now, says Wu Xiaoping, a Chinese human rights lawyer. By the 1990s, listening to VOA had become less sensitive in China, and more Chinese people tuned in to learn English. Lucy Hornby, a longtime China-focused journalist, was teaching in China at the time. And one student of hers in particular loved VOA.
His English name was Sydney, and he would come to my door and he would say, "This is Voice of America." And that's how I knew he was there.
Now VOA has come under criticism by Trump allies for being too expensive, and they say sympathetic to American adversaries. Hornby says the broadcaster positively shaped perceptions of the U.S. abroad.
They had a generally positive impression, not because they were getting all good news, actually. I think they respected that they were getting what felt like real news.
The impact went both ways. VOA trained generations of Chinese-speaking journalists. They covered on-the-ground news in China to a degree of detail unmatched by other Western outlets. Many who listened saw VOA as a window for people in China to understand the world and for the world to know what was going on in China. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Forever 21 has filed for bankruptcy again, and this time it could actually be forever as the company prepares to close all stores and wind down operations. Here is NPR's Alina Selyuk.
Peak Forever 21 was in the early 2000s when no self-respecting mall could go without the store. Vast and bright and chaotic, overrun by cute tank tops, tight skirts, and graphic tees.
I think it just had this really big kind of bodacious presence in the mall.
Tasha Lewis teaches fashion and retail studies at The Ohio State University. Forever 21 was often the draw, the reason young people came to the mall, a moment in time that had many millennials on TikTok reeling this week from the news of the store's demise. I'm sad, but I don't really shop there, says TikToker Zia Janae, and that is the basics of what went wrong with Forever 21. Greg Bortel, who advises retailers as a partner at the consulting firm Kearney, says the chain did not keep up with its shoppers.
So if we think about that first time when Forever 21 caught magic, it was among a particular consumer group. That consumer group changes and ages.
And you either choose to age with them or you fight for younger shoppers again and again and again.
You're only as good as your last season.
Forever 21 rose at the dawn of the fast fashion era, one of its original giants who would take styles you'd see on runways or magazine pages and bring them to your local mall in a blink of an eye and cheaply. It expanded aggressively. By 2010s, Lewis says she remembers trying to figure out the company's unique angle.
I never really got a sense of what their brand story was or what they were trying to say in terms of a fashion perspective. There was just a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff for little money. The main appeal was price.
And if that is your value proposition, you are vulnerable because someone else may figure out how to do it cheaper, and they did.
First came online rivals like Boohoo and ASOS and Fashion Nova. Forever 21 was losing money and shoppers. Some soured on fast fashion and the environmental impact. Others found competitors with fresher styles or higher quality. In 2019, the company declared bankruptcy for the first time. It survived as a shell of itself, bought out in a deal of two big mall operators and a brand licensing company. Then came the pandemic that shuttered stores and the rise of Temu and Shein, shipping clothes from China straight to American shoppers, even cheaper, even faster than Forever 21.
They just got beat.
Retail consultant Bortel again.
Yes, they were good, but what makes you good 10 years ago doesn't necessarily make you good today in retail, and that caught up with them.
Forever 21 tried another maneuver by partnering with Shein, giving Shein access to physical stores and Forever 21 a new online audience. That didn't help. One of the new Forever 21 owners later said that buying it was probably his biggest mistake. Today, what's left of the chain is back on the auction block, and it's unclear if anyone wants to buy what it has to offer. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can find more local stories at KAXE.org. 6 o'clock tonight, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7 o'clock, Malachi Coons is your host for On the River, a great mix of music. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. We also thank the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device, hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Slight chance of flurries this evening, mostly cloudy skies, lows in the 20s, and for tomorrow, partly sunny. Highs in the mid-30s, breezy north winds up to 30 miles per hour. Our lows tomorrow night in the 20s, and for Thursday, sunny with highs in the mid-40s. Northern Light Opera Company holds auditions for their summer musical Once Upon a Mattress this Friday, March 21st at 6 p.m. and Saturday, March 22nd, 1 p.m. at the Park Rapids Armory Arts and Event Center. Find more info at northernlightopera.org. University of Minnesota Extension presents Fridays with a Forester, an online series each Friday at 9 a.m. now through the end of April. These informal sessions will feature a different topic each week. To learn more and register, visit z.umn.edu/Fridays2025. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When people go missing in the United States, there is a system that can help law enforcement track them down. It is called the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, or NAMIS. But an NPR investigation finds that even in states legally required to use NAMIS, thousands of people are being left out. That includes one woman in Washington state named Benita Long. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz and Nick McMillan have her story.
Talani Long, her cousin Benita, is really more of a sister. When Lonnie was just 14, she came to live with Benita on the Yakima Nation Reservation in southern Washington. And she remembers how confident and strong Benita was even then.
She took us under her wing right away. She was more street smart. She was very outgoing. She could talk to anybody about anything.
These days, those memories are a comfort. Lonnie last saw her cousin almost 3 years ago. In fact, the last time anyone saw Benita was on March 26th in 2022 in Tompkins, Washington. It's not far from the reservation where Benita grew up and where much of her family still lives. It is also an area caught up in the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And it's become an all too common story in local news.
Indigenous people continue to go missing at a higher rate, an epidemic faced by communities across the world, but one that hits close to home with dozens missing from the Yakima Reservation.
Lonnie never thought Benita could be one of them.
I always believed, you know, that she could take care of herself. And I thought she would always be here.
But Benita is now one of the tens of thousands of people that have gone missing for more than a year. In 2007, a Justice Department agency created NAMIS to help track these cases. It pools info from law enforcement families and medical examiners. The federal government says it's a valuable tool to help close cold cases, but police don't often use it.
We found that about half of all of law enforcement agencies in the United States are not listed in NAMIS. Even in Washington and New Mexico, two states legally required to use the system, nearly 2,400 missing people weren't in the database. Benita Long is one of those people.
We want the best tools available for family members, for law enforcement, for researchers, to connect those dots, to create the leads so that we can get missing people back home.
That's Steve Strand. He's the executive director of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. That's the agency that, under state law, must submit cases like Benita's into NAMIS. But in the last 4 years, the agency's participation has been sporadic at best. We found that as of August 2024, about 65% of the state's nearly 2,350 missing people weren't listed in NAMIS.
I would say this, it's been a real challenge to work with NAMIS.
And we heard from other agencies, large and small. They also said that they find the system hard to use and just too time-consuming to be useful. NAMIS requires 19 fields to be filled out when submitting missing persons reports, and it rejects reports that leave out even a single field. That's a problem because when police first record their cases, they use a different database that doesn't ask for all the same information that NAMIS does.
There's no provision if some of that data simply doesn't exist or we can't obtain it.
Strand said his organization has tried to get NAMIS to agree to some temporary workarounds. The folks that run NAMIS admitted that there are problems with the system. But they said that any fixes could cost tens of millions of dollars.
Up until this point, nobody has really cared that our loved ones have gone missing and murdered. We weep in silence and in invisibility.
Abigail Echo Hawk, who leads a nonprofit and advocates for the indigenous population, says these kinds of systemic problems hurt vulnerable people, like her community. Benita Long's family didn't know she wasn't included in AMIS until we told them. Lonnie said she's not sure Benita is still alive. Without any answers from police, Lonnie has looked for ways to find some closure. She asked her husband, Israel, for help. He's a sun dancer, and she asked him to help connect with family members who have passed during a ceremony 6 months after Benita went missing.
You know, and find Benita wherever she's at in her spirit to take her home so that she's not left here.
Lonnie says that's the last thing she could do to show Benita love in this world. If you know anything about Benita Long's case, please contact the Yakima Nation Police. Jacqueline Diaz.
And Nick McMillan, NPR News.
And a note, the Yakima Nation Police, the agency that Benita Long's family first reported her missing to, has not responded to multiple inquiries from NPR.
Remember me.
Remember me.
We want to close out this hour remembering a trailblazing writer. Felice Pacano died last week at the age of 81. Pacano was openly gay at a time when that could mean facing condemnation, discrimination, and physical violence. He wrote 8 volumes of memoirs and 17 novels, and he founded Seahorse Press, one of the country's first publishers focused on LGBT writers.
One of Pacano's best-known novels was The Lure. Published in 1979, the psychological thriller explored gay life and sexuality at a time when many mainstream writers steered clear of the topic. Pacano said it was the first gay-themed book to be featured in the Book of the Month Club.
Well, I think the first generation of really openly gay writers in the 70s, people like Ed White, Andrew Halloran, Larry Kramer, Felice Pacano, they were the first people to come out publicly and to risk their careers doing it.
In 1987, Michael Denny, an author and editor who championed LGBT writers, spoke to NPR.
And when the second generation of writers came along, it was a much more accepted thing. I mean, the novels didn't have to be as political. Rather than being about gay life, they were about life as it was experienced by a gay man.
Douglas Sadownick is an author and psychotherapist. He and Pacano first bonded over writing when Sadownick asked him to review one of his manuscripts. They were friends for over 30 years.
He was very caring. He wanted gay people to be healthy, to be well. People thought he was a, you know, tough cookie, but he only was that way if you thought you were, you know, being fake or something. So he was a person who cared for the world.
Pacano spoke to NPR on December 1st, 1995, World AIDS Day. He described finding an invitation list from a huge birthday party bash 10 years earlier. And for him, the names were a memorial to the devastation of the AIDS epidemic.
And I went down the list. There was one person who I could not account for his where he is at all. And of everybody else on the list, they were all dead. So 74 names. It wasn't just authors and famous people. It was my, my attorney. It was the guy who sold me my newspapers every day. It was my barber. This affected everybody. You know, and luckily for many years I was living in, you know, what was pretty much a gay world, and it got decimated piece by piece by piece.
Pacano's death was announced on Facebook by his publisher, Rebel Satori Press. The company said Pacano's work showed his storytelling prowess and also his commitment to examining the complexities of love, sexuality, and the human experience.
People close to Pacano say he was glad to live as long as he did. The cause of his death, according to the New York Times, was complications from lymphoma.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. at ajws.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Our weather for tonight, slight chance of flurries, lows in the 20s, and tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the mid-30s with breezy north winds 10 to 20, gusting up to 30 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night, 23 to 29, and for Thursday, sunny, highs in the mid-40s. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through